Kids Comics.
And here are your hosts, Michael and Andrew Leyland.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome back to this month's Hey Kids Comics. I'd like to tell you what month this month's Hey Kids Comics is, but I don't know yet.
Yeah, we don't need to be bogged down by that because it makes us more timeless.
It does, that's very true. I'm Andrew Leyland.
And I'm Michael Leyland.
And we're here to be your guide through whatever the hell comics we decide to cover this week.
Which you do know because it's
because
the
I've done
the
little picture and the episode. And also, we've been expecting you, Mr. Bond. Because we've promised this for a while.
Okay.
The James Bond one. But before we start, I think it should be...
No, we're rummaging.
Brought to our attention that, first of all...
Right.
All the James Bond films are Amazon Prime.
They won't be when this episode goes
up. They put them on again for what? A month?
They
two
do,
months?
Which is... I think it's taken me... through 2 years to watch through
because you'll get so far and then they'll take them off for free and then they'll put them back on again and so on and so forth,
which is frustrating, but I don't know what the deal is with MGM or the Broccoli's for them to have to do that.
I think Amazon has the rights to the James Bond franchise.
Okay.
I think MGM has sold up to Amazon.
But weirdly, you can watch them on ITVX as well.
Yes, because ITVX have signed an exclusive deal to keep transmitting them on linear television.
Yeah.
And to put them on ITVX, they have to show them a certain amount of times.
Right.
Which is why you will have noticed that Goldfinger was on one morning at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
Just so they could keep it on ITVX platform.
I do miss the days when Roger Moore films mostly were a staple of British Sunday bank holidays.
Yep. Normally The Spy Who Loved Me or Moonraker.
Yeah, yeah.
For Connery, it was normally Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah.
You know, the most innocuous ones. So, yeah, they were staples for the bank holidays. The thing is, though, with the ITVX, my God, that's a shit platform.
It's awful.
Yeah, absolutely
awful.
Dreadful.
Yeah.
And the adverts are pointless.
And the volume...
And it'll freeze to go to the adverts.
Yeah.
And then freeze to come back.
Yeah.
And it's just such a terrible platform.
And they'll be really quiet, but then the ads will be really loud. Mm-hmm. So the benefit is I've watched a couple of Sharps on ITVX, and Sharp actually has ad breaks, and conveniently they've lined them up.
They've actually put some thought into that.
Yeah, you don't always get that. Sometimes I've noticed...
No, they're just in the middle of a sentence.
Yeah. But yeah, so... for that, they've done a good job.
So I went all the way back to the beginning, and I watched all the Connerys.
Right.
Because they're Sharp. As a pin prince.
Okay.
Except, weirdly, Thunderball.
Okay.
Thunderball looks washed out.
Right.
And doesn't look as good as the other three. Goldfinger from Russia with Love and Doctor No look brilliant. Doctor No, particularly, was very vibrant.
Okay, yeah.
And colourful. Thunderball, the one you'd think would be the most colourful because of all the underwater and we're in the Bahamas and all that stuff. No, it looks a bit crap.
Wonder if it was an issue with the actual footage or the film, though.
I don't know, because I don't remember it looking like that on the Blu-ray. Because, yes, I have them on the Blu-ray as well. But, yeah, it's a bit weird. But then I saw this is going off in 30 days. And all right, well, I'm not going to get through all of Roger.
Yeah.
So I skipped straight to Sir Timothy of Dalton and watched The Living Daylights.
Yes.
And we watched that roughly the same time.
We did.
What did you think of The Living Daylights?
Oh, we're doing this conversation?
Yeah,
we're getting right into it.
Let's do this conversation.
The Living Daylights. And the thing is, as well, is contextually, the Roger Moore films, for me, were a slog. And I don't think it helped that I was in the middle of the Roger Moore films when Amazon Prime said, see you again next year.
Yeah.
And I think we watched a couple in between as well.
We watched Moonraker.
Moonraker.
Yeah, we watched Moonraker together.
So the Roger...
Take Mr. Bond. Put him out of my misery.
The Roger Moore films were very much a slog. And, you know, I'm very, very sorry if Roger Moore is your James Bond. He's not mine.
I love Roger Moore.
The worst thing about Roger Moore's run is his best film is his last one.
What?
And that's with the caveat that one of my favourite Bond films is The Man with the Golden Gun. So,
I love The Man with the Golden Gun.
I don't
get the hate for that film.
I love The Man with the Golden Gun. It's not Moore's best.
Oh, no.
But
it's fun.
Moore's best is...
His best is The Spy Who Loved Me. I don't think that's the best one.
It's not.
My favourites are The Spy Who Loved Me, The Man with the Golden Gun, and I love For Your Eyes Only.
His best is A View to a Kill.
It is not.
It is.
It's no way.
It really is.
I'm sorry, no.
Anyway. So with all of this kind of in mind, it was genuinely refreshing in a way that I imagine Casino Royale After Die Another Day was.
Yes.
To see a younger, punchier, rougher, charming, handsome young Bond again. And I think the jump to the 80s really worked in Dalton's favour. It was genuinely like a bolt of fresh blood. It was just more vibrant, more pulpier again. And so it was really refreshing. And it's there was a few moments in it, and I remember especially the bit where he's joined the Mujahideen, and there's a shot where the camels and horses and the riders are silhouetted against this dark morning sky.
It looks cinematic again.
And I'm sat there thinking, this is cinema. This feels cinematic. Because, yeah, it didn't look cheap or feel cheap. It felt like cinema.
Yeah. They'd cut back on the naff rear projection.
Yeah.
It's still there a little bit in the fight at the end.
Yeah.
Where they're clinging to all the drugs that have fallen out the back of the plane, and they're clinging to the netting.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of dodgy rear projection there.
But the the theme's great. The reimagining of the short story Living Daylights works with it.
Right, they scared the living daylights out of her.
Dalton's punny without being Roger Moore obnoxious with it.
Well, Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton, again, I was there. In 1987, that seemed like a massive...
Yeah.
Reset of the Bond franchise.
And in a way, it was.
And Dalton only took the role if he could play the guy from the book. Because he was offered it in 69.
Right.
For On His Majesty's Secret Service and couldn't do it because he was far too young. So he elected not to do it at that point.
Right.
My alternate universe Bond is loads of people say how good he's on Her Majesty's Secret Service with Connery. No. My alternate universe is Roger Moore does on Her Majesty's Secret Service as his first Bond.
Right.
He gets to act in it, which he doesn't in a lot of the Bond movies.
Yeah.
His first one is a serious movie. How does that change the trajectory of Roger Moore's time as Bond?
Right.
And then you get to For Your Eyes Only. Assuming you still do the same films.
Yeah.
For Your Eyes Only, Dalton takes over.
Okay.
Because For Your Eyes Only is a much better film with Dalton in it than with Roger Moore in it. Roger's starting to look a little bit long in the tooth.
Yeah.
And you've also got the thing that For Your Eyes Only was written without them knowing who was going to play James Bond.
Okay, yeah.
So it was written to work either as a new Bond, which is why the opening is him visiting Tracy's grave and ditching Blofeld. To essentially shunt the past out of the way.
Yeah.
And then we've got a new Bond now.
There's a thing is, though, that only works the way it works because it's Roger Moore.
I could argue having Rod, but you don't know that. It could work the way they intended it with a new guy.
There's no way that, let's say it did go to Timothy Dalton, there is absolutely no way that Timothy Dalton dropping Blofeld down the chimney would have worked. I'm sorry, it only works because it's Roger Moore.
I kind of think it would be funny. But anyway, that you know, if that alternate reality happens, then that version of For Your Eyes Only doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Does it? But either way, Dalton takes over at For Your Eyes Only and gets all of the 80s.
Yeah.
And so in the 80s, because you've got that bit in For Your Eyes Only that Roger kicked back against, where he murders that guy in cold blood because he killed the Contessa.
Yeah.
And just kicks his car off the cliff.
Yeah.
And Roger kicked back against that, saying, this is a bit much. And they're like, no, this is James Bond.
Yeah.
And Roger toned him down a bit. And I think Timothy Dalton would have killed him that scene.
Yeah.
But License to Kill, it's not as brave a departure now as it seemed in 1987.
But
you've still got the cello thing. We have nothing to declare.
Oh, I'm glad I told you to go back for it.
glad I told you to go back for the cello.
The thing is, though, even now within context, it still feels like...
But yeah, when you're watching them back to back,
yeah,
it does feel like somebody just slapped you about the first bit.
The worst thing, though, about it is that the film that would follow, and unfortunately Dalton's last one, is just Miami Vice. It's incredibly ropey. It rehashes Live and Let Die.
Which provided John Gardner a lot of problems when he novelised it.
And so it was tonally all over the place. It felt like what if Roger Moore was in a Sean Connery film. And it just wasn't as good. And it was really ropey. And it's just, unfortunately, it's just a shame that that was the last one.
See, for the longest time, I was like, well, Robert Davi's a TV villain. Because he'd literally been an A-team villain. Yep. He was literally one of Stephen J. Cannell's go-to guys.
Well, he was very TV villainy as well.
Oh, and because you're watching that, and I'm going, the A-team took this guy out in an hour. Why is it taking James Bond so long?
Yeah.
But going back now, it's more brutal and violent than any of the others.
Yeah.
Blowing that guy's head up.
Yeah.
But Dalton's great in it. And I think when you look at it as part of the overall canon, it now being an episode of Miami Vice with James Bond in it works in its favour. Because yeah. It's an outlier now.
Yeah. And it's quite interesting as well with it being a loose adaptation of the Kurosawa film. Oh, not an adaptation, but reimagining of the Kurosawa film Yojimbo. Mm. The last act of that is Yojimbo. Bond plays both sides against each other.
Mm.
It's straight from Yojimbo and Sanjiro as well. So that was actually quite interesting as well, once you kind of clock on that, oh, that's what they're doing, is taking what if Akira Kurosawa and Toshiro Mifune adapted Risiko.
Mm.
It was quite an interesting approach, I thought, with it.
And what's interesting about it as well, again, now watching it as part of the whole canon, how much of Daniel Craig is in Timothy Dalton?
Yeah.
And the audience weren't ready for it then. They'd had 2 decades of Roger Moore.
Yeah.
They were not ready for a Bond who was that brutal. And that final action sequence in License to Kill, one of the few times you genuinely thought Bond was in trouble.
Yeah. The problem with having read the books and kind of watching the films at a similar time is the books are completely different from the films and are better.
The character of Bond is much better in the books.
And so for...
Despite the racism and the obsession with food.
But the thing about going into the films, kind of having read the books as well, is the films never actually do James Bond. He's a...
Dalton's close.
Yeah.
Craig is very close.
Yeah, it's like, as I was saying too, if the idea in my head of the novel James Bond is something like a Hoagie Carmichael, but with Daniel Craig's Bond's personality, you've got your perfect Bond there.
Mm.
The problem is there aren't really any actors who look like Hoagie Carmichael anymore, so you can't do that. But that's the closest they've got. If you did have like a... Daniel Craig roughness with a handsome silver screen actor, you've got your ideal Bond there, really. But yeah, it was kind of interesting how the films have always done a character of James Bond, never James Bond. They've come close, but they've just never quite passed that threshold for whatever reason.
Yeah, Connery's close in the first couple.
Yeah.
And then even he starts sending it up a bit, so you get Diamonds Are Forever.
It's just the most successful Bond got. He was always a bit too cute. And then when he got a bit too cute, they'd reset him.
Mm.
And then he would get a bit too cute again. And it's, yeah.
And every time they do that, they do the same thing. We're going back to basics. And then they just get more and more outlandish.
Yeah.
So then you get to GoldenEye.
Yes.
And the funny thing about that is there was a 6-year gap there because of the lawsuits.
Yeah.
And everyone was predicting it would flop because 6 years between films is far too long. And we're now at the point where how many years have there been in between James Bond films?
Yeah.
And Indiana Jones films?
Yeah.
And well, the fact that the last one flopped may kind of say that maybe there was too long in between.
Well, we all just love legacy sequels now.
Yeah, well, so James Bond even does, what, is there 5 years in between Spectre and No Time to Die?
No.
5 years in between Skyfall and Spectre?
I mean, the thing is, those are very... unintentional.
Well, no, Spectre wasn't. They could have got Spectre out quicker.
I mean, No
Time to Die should have come out in 2020.
Because it was finished, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They just used the time.
The promotion was in swing.
Yeah, yeah.
Daniel Craig was on the cover of a bunch of magazines in the April of 2020.
Yes.
For a film that was coming out in the May of 2020, and then the world stopped.
Yeah. They used that time to just kind of refine elements, though, didn't they?
Yeah, and if it was me, I would have used that time to go to top directors of the day and say, right, work on your own script and we'll get them out. And we won't let people forget because they're in danger of letting it pass again now.
It's no.
Yeah, probably not.
James Bond is a cultural sweetheart. The thing is, like, a James Bond film will never flop.
None of them have. Everyone likes to say No Time to Die flop because it was woke. It didn't flop.
It didn't flop.
It didn't make the amount of money back that it should have made because of what it cost.
And at the same time, when it came out.
But it still made nearly $1 billion at
yeah.
the box office. And also, it cost twice as much as any other Bond film.
Yeah.
They need to rein that spending in.
Yeah.
And half of that went on Daniel Craig, who's done nothing but bitch about it since. It's like, for God's sake, it made you a billionaire. Stop whining about it.
I love Daniel Craig. And I absolutely, it's fascinating. And you see it a lot, Dave Bautista said as well, is when working on Bond together, you could tell that there was a lot of pressure and stress on Daniel and he wasn't likable. And then he said when doing Knives Out again, suddenly you didn't have this pressure of him being James Bond anymore and he was this really nice, happy guy. Mm. I do think, for all your bitching and whining about how much it makes you a billionaire, there's got to be an insane amount of pressure on you to be James Bond. That does not come without a cost.
No, to your private life.
And... yeah. And he even said it in the documentary that came out before No Time to Die, where Daniel Craig suddenly... is just relieved of this pressure in a way that I imagine Harrison Ford was after Star Wars, where he's happy to talk about it again because he's out of that pressure. And just saying that the thing that he struggled with the most was going from a very unknown crime actor.
Yeah, he was in Our Friends in the North on BBC.
To being one of the biggest stars in the world. Again, that does not come with a cost.
And he just hid away from it, really. Yeah. He didn't become a... what's his name? But then he went to GoldenEye... and you didn't like GoldenEye.
I just did not care for it. At no point did it grab me. I didn't...
and yet Pierce Brosnan should have been your Bond.
And he was. But I just didn't gel with it the way that I kind of wanted to. And there's a few things. First, I must admit there were places in GoldenEye where I just genuinely felt like I just didn't get what was happening.
The plot is quite convoluted.
It's kind of like, I don't know if it was me or the plot, but I was going, oh right, okay, and now we're following this survivor from the base now because she's important, I guess. And there's just bits about it, and with Pierce Brosnan specifically, he's a bit too much of a swat or a square for the American audiences. He's playing it very straight. He's very suave and handsome and toned down. There's no roughness to him. The gags that he delivers, he's delivering them as if he doesn't know that they're a gag. There's the bit with M where she says he's an archaic dinosaur, which could have been interesting if this were not the first film of a young actor.
Hmm.
Everything about it...
he's not old enough to have really been in the Cold War that much.
It didn't gel. It just didn't vibe. And it just didn't work for me, really, in the way that Living Daylights was very punchy. This was just much bit more subdued.
Mm.
And you'd think that a car chase with a tank would be a little more exciting.
They took that back in and re-edited it and rescored it because the music was flat.
It just felt, ultimately, the whole thing just felt a bit... it's just not as... I think I was expecting more for the first film of a new Bond actor.
Mm. It does play it very safe
mm.
because essentially it's reintroducing him after six years away.
Yeah.
And Brosnan was a very safe pair of hands and there was no real challenge there in casting him. And I get what you're saying. I like the pre-credit sequence.
The pre-credit sequence is good, yeah.
I like New Money Penny.
Mm.
I like his relationship with Q, which has developed much more into a more avuncular.
See, I liked Q hating Bond.
Yeah. So when you get the feeling Q hated Sean Connery's Bond.
Yeah.
Barely tolerated Roger Moore's Bond.
Yeah.
You didn't get enough of a vibe in with Dalton because he only did the two. Yeah. But in Living License to Kill, he seems to like him.
Yeah, which this is a me thing. I like Q hating Bond because it's funny.
Mm.
That gives you an interesting, funny dynamic between the two.
But yeah, with Brosnan, he seems to be a bit more avuncular, doesn't he? He seems to quite like Pierce Brosnan.
And I do like the dynamic between him and M, though. Judi Dench should have been in it more.
Which she is as we go along.
Yeah. Because the thing that made the book so interesting is Bond loves M as much as he despises him. The impression that I got of their relationship was kind of like Bond sees M as a father figure who he does get on with, but is also scared of him because M's not afraid to take the belt off. Because there's bits where Bond admires him. They do get on. They go to
clubs together.
What's it called? Blades.
Yeah.
They go to Blades. And there's a great bit. The entire first act of Moonraker is Bond and M playing Baccarat together. Mm. And all that stuff's great. But then you get bits where Bond is anxious and scared to step in to M's office. He's worried how M's going to look at him. He can read the look that M gives him. And there's so many little interesting subtle bits between that kind of dynamic. where Bond is scared of and admires and loves, but also hates this man.
Mm.
And it's very, very interesting. So it was interesting to see that role reversed in the film where M actively hates Bond.
Right.
And it plays in really well of my interpretation of Skyfall, which is a disgruntled employee who is begging his boss to see him as a person and not just a statistic or a blank worker, to the point where he kidnaps her and goes, look, this is my life, this is my old house, these are my parents, please see me as a person. And ultimately that doesn't pay off, and he has to realize that he is just a cog in the grand machine. That's a fascinating and existentially depressing
M scene in GoldenEye. Think I won't send you to your death, 007.
Really interesting dynamic, and it just gives it a whole element to Bond that I think is so very easily lost. You can lose Bond in this just single layer, two-dimensional character, very much the way he was in the Roger Moore era, when actually if you kind of allow yourself to delve deeper into Bond, there's some interesting stuff you can do with that.
Which the Daniel Craig ones try to explore.
Yeah.
Not always successfully. Skyfall, they do it successfully.
Yeah.
Spectre, not so much.
Yeah. Because you've got a great bit in Casino Royale, the very, very first Bond book, which would ultimately define that character, where Bond wants to be a person, is betrayed by the person he's fallen in love with, and there's an amazing bit in the last chapter where Fleming has Bond essentially kind of like do an internal monologue where he says, well, if I'm a weapon, let me be a weapon. Like, I will bury my feelings and my emotions, but if I am going to work for bad people, let me be a weapon against other bad people then. And that's really, really interesting, because it kind of admits that the British Empire were scumbags, which a lot of British people weren't doing at the time, but says, well, at least there are other scumbags, and I'm a cog in the machine and a weapon. And it's really, really interesting that...
And it's interesting, a lot of people who criticise the Fleming books don't see that side of it.
Again, that would be forgotten and moved aside, especially in the films, but ultimately that is a really fascinating layer of the character if you allow it to be there.
This is when there are people complaining the Daniel Craig era was this and there was that. To me, that is still the closest they have ever got to adapting the guy who is in the books.
Yeah.
And No Time to Die is a better adaptation of You Only Live Twice than You Only Live Twice is.
Yeah.
Now, we say all that to say this. Today's show is devoted to the James Bond of the comics. Not just any comics, the new Dynamite comics. Bond. James Bond. Has been a mainstay of popular culture since his 1953 debut in the novel Casino Royale. Created by Ian Fleming, a former naval intelligence officer, the novels became worldwide bestsellers, cementing Bond as a pop culture icon, even before the film series. Taking the books and adapting them into films nonetheless took Bond to new heights, even if they did start with the sixth book in the series, Dr. No. Despite coming 10 years later, the movies did impact the books, with the casting of Sean Connery as James Bond causing Fleming to retroactively state that Bond's father, Andrew Bond, was of Scottish descent. So what is it about Bond that endures? Certainly, the literary version of the character, despite featuring many noble qualities, also features some less savoury aspects, especially as viewed through a 21st century lens. But he has been an icon now for over 70 years and over five generations. He's weathered 70s feminism, the 90s new man, and noughties cancel culture, and despite many still saying he's dated or past his prime, he endures, ageless, incorruptible, indefatigable. He may be a sexist, misogynistic dinosaur, a relic of the Cold War, but every now and again a trigger needs pulling, and nobody does that better than Bond. At a recent NATO conference for world leaders, it was stated that the world is now more dangerous than it has been for decades, and as long as that continues, so will Bond. Bond, however, has evolved, whilst remaining resolutely true to himself. He's had to, for society has evolved as well. Values change, regimes shift, but Bond remains Bond, no matter the government in power or the enemies we may face. Forever mid-30s to early 50s, Bond takes on any task, faces any foe, steadfast and true. A brusque hero, yes. A hero who kills for pay, certainly. not always a likeable hero, but a hero who will get the job done, no matter the personal cost, no matter what it takes. There's also a wish fulfillment angle to Bond. Men want to be a man who travels the world on an apparently limitless expense account, beds beautiful women, wears expensive suits, drives magnificent cars, shoots, skis and abseils, and kills bad men with impunity, a raised eyebrow and a cocky smirk. Whoever plays Bond should look like a man who'd kill you and then bed your girlfriend. Women, despite what some may write, wouldn't mind a crack at Bond. I know a few personally, women who are more than capable, who love a Bond who's a bit of a bastard, a bit of a rogue, a bit of a sexist. But Bond isn't only a literary and celluloid figure, he's also a comic book hero. James Bond comics started being published as newspaper strips in July 1958, predating the films, with an adaptation of Casino Royale in the Daily Express. They adapted all the novels and short stories, Risico, From a View to a Kill, For Your Eyes Only and The Living Daylights, up to 1966, when they started padding out Fleming's other shorts and novels to make them longer and more action-packed due to the success of the films. Extra scenes were added to The Man with the Golden Gun, Octopussy, The Hildebrand Rarity and The Spy Who Loved Me, before moving on to original stories, apart from an adaptation of Kingsley Amis's Bond novel, Colonel's Son, in 1969. The strip ran until 1983, when midway through the story Polestar, it was cancelled without warning. However, it was wrapped up by a Swiss newspaper, who continued Bond's newspaper strip's adventures through 1991. I wonder if the Swiss have a fondness for Bond due to his mother, Monique Delacroix, being from Sweden. An adaptation of Dr. No appeared in Classic Illustrated in 1962 and was reprinted in Showcase by DC Comics in early 1963. And Marvel Comics published adaptations of For Your Eyes Only and Octopussy in 1981 and 1983 respectively. Eclipse Comics published an adaptation of License to Kill in 1989, but Topps Comics' adaptation of GoldenEye, despite being advertised as a three-issue series, saw only one issue see print. Dark Horse Comics then picked up the license, followed by Marvel Comics, who published a James Bond Jr. comic to tie in with the cartoon of the same name, before Dynamite picked up the license directly from Fleming Publishing in 2017. This series would be different, as it would be the literary Bond they would be adapting, rather than the cinematic Bond. Two completely different people, although they share DNA, as you just mentioned. For this show, we will be looking at Varga and Edolin, written by Wallen Ellis, with art by Jason Masters, Hammerhead and Killchain by Andy Diggle and Luca Casalanguida, and Your Cold, Cold Heart by Garth Ennis and Rafa Lobosco. We've also got the graphic novel in there as well.
Yeah.
But that was a one-shot graphic novel that was not initially comic book on its own. So, first of all, and the one that kicked the series off, Varga. Bond is assigned a simple mission to take over the recently deceased 008 caseload and investigate a new designer drug infiltrating not just the UK, but elsewhere. The CIA send Felix to give Bond the necessary intel, which involves a trip to Europe to dispose of a small, nimble drug production operation that is moving tainted narcotics into Britain. This involves speaking with a CIA informant, a medical technology mogul called Slaven Krujak. And that's where it all goes wrong for Bond. What did you think of Varga?
I just didn't...
You didn't jive with this one, did you?
I didn't gel. It didn't gel. And neither of these gel, the two Warren Ellis ones.
Right.
Because it's a weird one. It's supposed to be the book Bond.
It's supposed to be, yes, because the license is with Fleming.
There's several lines of dialogue in the Ellis. We'll forget this later on. I think Andy Diggle drops it completely.
Yeah. No, Andy Diggle puts literary Bond in a film plot.
No, it's more a case of Warren Ellis drops several lines of dialogue that heavily imply that this is the same James Bond as the books.
Yes.
And there's even lines where Bond will say, oh, I used to do this back in at post-war.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work in the way that this is. It's set in the modern day.
Yeah.
Were this a period piece, that would have been just much more interesting and probably could have taken that element off the backs, because Andy Diggle just has a sliding timeline, whereas Ellis firmly states that this is the same Bond.
Mm.
He was still doing the things in the books when the books were set.
Yes. And it it's even modelled on Fleming's description of him.
Yeah.
Right down to the scar and the comma of her.
Yeah. Which, again, it's fine. But this, here, the sliding timeline, which even Fleming introduced himself, would have worked better. Instead, this feels like Ellis wanting a bit too much to state it's the same person.
Yeah.
Doing the same things at the same time. And it just didn't gel. It didn't kind of work. It's like, well, no, why? Because why is he not in his 80s, 90s? Why is he still doing this as a young man, clearly in his 30s?
See, this was one of my favourite things I've written by Ellis.
Right.
I mean, I'm not a big Warren Ellis fan.
No.
And the only thing I can honestly say is I ever really enjoyed was Transmet.
Yeah, it's just, I felt like it was kind of just such a shame that Ellis was one of the, you know, bigger, exciting writers at the time and separated from everything else in recent history.
Mm.
He just kind of seems to be doing very low-key, cashy's paycheck, licensed stuff at the moment. And it's by no means is this exciting or interesting. I just get the impression that Ellis is just doing this for the paycheck.
Because what's weird about that is he did do an interview
long
before he got this.
Yeah.
Where the interview asked him, were there anything he wants to take a crack at, or is you going to be creator-owned all the time from now on?
Yeah.
And he said, honestly, the only thing I'd be interested in taking a crack at would be James Bond.
Right.
And he actually said in that interview, I remember this distinctly, because when he got the gig, I remember thinking, oh, right, somebody else read that interview.
Yeah.
He said, but it would be the Bond from the books.
Yeah.
That's the one I'm interested in, not the guy in the films. And it's Ellis, so you're right, it rattles along. And I thought Master's Art was quite simple. It was clean lines, it was easy to understand, it's not overly detailed.
See, I felt the opposite.
So you didn't like the art, did you?
I didn't like, but I know Masters as a fill-in artist from Batman Incorporated.
Right. And I didn't know him at all.
In subsequent reprints, Chris Burnham's gone back and redrawn everything, so Masters isn't a guest artist.
It's been retconned.
Exactly. And you can clearly see there's elements here where you can see...
See, maybe that's why I didn't know him, because I've only read that in the hardcovers,
yeah,
which is the remastered versions, yeah, isn't it?
So you can clearly see that he went to the same school as Chris Burnham and Frank Quitely. There was some interesting layouts going on here.
Mm.
Unfortunately, I don't think he's quite good enough a fundamental artist to pull it off.
Mm.
You've got some bits that look a bit too... look fine, but you've got some bits where it'll be a small panel where you can clearly see that he's worked digital because maybe a background character has got a super detailed face, but it's very far in the distance.
Mm-mm.
And then there's sometimes where the characters are very much off model. And then there's some just strange, interesting layouts that come off just a bit too boring.
Yeah.
So there's bits that kind of confuse me because the focal point isn't in focus. Like, there's a scene where Moneypenny hands Bond a knife, but you don't see the knife. The knife is, like, at the side of the panel and the focus is something in the background.
Right.
There's a bit where there's a car crash, but it's a splash page. The car crashes at the top and the rest of the page is blank.
Yeah.
And then there's a double page spread in the second one.
Second issue.
Where Bond...
Bond's
in the underground train station. And the entire page is blank apart from some slight silhouettes.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't understand what he was thinking at times. Because he just has boring, like, just layouts. And it's just not exciting as you would expect from a James Bond comic.
Well, see, I thought the cold open was nice and brutal. What's going on there?
Can you genuinely say what's going on in that?
It's a shot of a train in the dark.
Where you can barely make out Bond all the way to the side. You can barely make out the outlines of what should be the focal point, the bad guys.
Yeah.
It's kind of very
muddy.
Yeah. The art was either boring or confusing.
Yeah.
But very, very stylized.
Yeah, I kind of see what you're saying now that you're saying it. I didn't mind the art. I thought it was... My thing with Dynamite is I always think they spend an awful lot of money on the covers.
Yes, and thousands of covers.
That's where they spend their money. I mean, issue one of Virga had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 24 different covers.
Yeah.
And like you've pointed out when we discussed, not a lot of them are different. A lot of them are just variations on a cover. Like, but quite a lot of them are different.
Yeah.
In this particular case.
I suppose with this one as well, it was the first issue of a new publisher.
This was the launch, yeah. But you've also got to think, all those artists need paying for those covers.
Yeah.
So that is presumably taking away from what you can pay for the interior artist.
Yeah.
And there mustn't be a shortage of artists who would like to work on James Bond. Mm. Brian Hitch would kill. James Bond.
I think the thing with Dynamite, and absolutely, you know, no disrespect to Dynamite, but they don't exactly have the most A list of talent pools.
For their interiors, I would agree. I think they spend a lot of money on the covers.
Well, because reading these as well, like the big thing that they're doing at the moment with the Garth Ennis series is Red Sonja and Vampirella. They would have double page splash adverts.
Yeah.
And the big thing you've got going on is look at how many different,
covers.
Top tier poster variant covers we've got.
Yeah. I thought he did okay with it. I think he's a much more brutal James Bond. He's not bedding a woman every 5 minutes. There are a couple of cute one-liners that aren't smarmy dad gags, which get my vote. I did think it was interesting that M doesn't resemble any M we've ever seen in the books, in the comics, in the films.
Yeah.
He's Captain Doobie, isn't he? From Starsky and Hutch. He looks more like Don Warrington. That's who he reminded me of.
Well, they did make me think all the people who want Idris Elba to potentially be Bond would be...
He is M now.
He'd be a much better M, yeah.
Yeah, he's aged out of being Bond.
Yeah.
Moneypenny is clearly Naomi Harris.
Yeah.
Though. And Bill Tanner doesn't look like anyone who's ever played Bill Tanner.
No.
Now, with Felix, I'm never bothered because Felix is never the same actor twice.
Yeah.
Until you get to the Daniel Craig film.
Because that's another thing as well. Felix Leiter is in it quite prominently.
Yeah.
But it's the same Felix Leiter who did all the same things in the books.
Yes,
because
he's
say
got
that
the bionic
hand
and arm,
hasn't he? Again, that's an interesting thing because how did he get his legs eaten off him in the 50s?
Hmm.
And yet still be a 20-year-old with long hair and cybernetic limbs.
I presume he must be applying this idea that Fleming's novels didn't happen in the 50s.
Well, Fleming played about that. I think there's a bit in...
Yeah, Fleming de-ages Bond as the books go along.
But again, this is saying... Bond is talking about doing things after World War II. Bond is talking about operating in the Cold War.
Hmm.
Bond is clearly not old enough in this to
be operating
in the Cold War.
Could he be operating in the 80s Cold War? If you're fiddling around with it. Varga, for those that are interested, is an old Norse word meaning wolf, evildoer or destroyer. So there you go. There's that silly plot device of the hard rule.
Yeah.
That piece of legislation that states a UK Secret Service officer cannot carry a weapon on home soil.
Yeah.
I could not find out if that was real, because that seems like a very stupid rule.
And there's a big deal made about it for it to barely have any payoff in the next one as well.
And it's not like you go, well, he's not going to find a way around that, is he?
Yeah.
Because he does. Because he has to. Q is never called Q, did you notice? He's only ever referred to as Major Boothroyd.
They do mention Q Branch.
Yes, but he's never called Q.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, so right, is that a film thing? Because in the first film, he's called Major Boothroyd.
But he's called... But he is called Q in the book.
Is he?
Or at the very least, it's still... Oh, I don't know.
I didn't remember if he was ever specifically called Q. He works for Q Branch.
Yeah.
And his character is Major Boothroyd. And I cannot remember if he's ever just called Q in the books.
Because the thing with this... Despite it wanting to be the Book Bond never had the gadgets the movie version did, but this, the comic version
does. He has
a
few.
For all it's saying that it wants to be the book version, this is ultimately a reinterpretation of the Book Bond character in the film setting. Because this is very action, gratuitous violence that the films would carry.
Yeah, the violence in it was sometimes a little bit over the top.
I did get taken out of it when you got a full-on exploding headshot. I did feel a bit like,
And what did you think about that bullet that they explain in this? When you fire it in the human body, it splits into fragments.
Oh, yeah.
Causing untold damage to your internal organs. And on the one hand, if that's true, it's impressive the horrific way we come up with killing each other.
Yeah.
That's quite impressive. But the artistic depiction of that sometimes made me wince a little bit.
I mean...
Because they actually show it going in his eye.
Yeah.
And then splitting up six shards of bullet going through his brain.
It's not very covert, though, is it? Like, you're supposed to be a spy. Why would a spy use a shotgun?
Well, you've also got the thing, if that particular ammunition is only being made by certain people, you're going to be able to trace where it's from then, aren't you?
Yeah.
And I think they do actually mention that about it. I thought the opening to issue 4 was a bit silly. Bond is picked up by someone we know to be one of the drug runners.
Yeah.
And then he has an open conversation on the phone. Bond clocks him as a bad guy straight away.
Yeah.
What follows, Bond and M talk on the phone
in
what is clearly spy code.
The thing is, it's not even good spy code.
No.
Because he basically kind of just says,
"Hey, Grandad,
I am speaking in code to you."
He almost literally has a neon sign over there saying, "I am speaking in code."
Yeah.
If the bad guy didn't spot that, he deserves to be killed.
Well, the bad guys...
That's how stupid he is.
The bad guys didn't seem that smart anyway. And I didn't feel kind of... I didn't get the bad guys. They were bad because they were bad. And that's it. There was nothing interesting about them. They weren't the fun bad guys.
He's not as interesting as the lady villain in the Andy Diggle ones later on, who's Make Britain Great Again.
Yes, yeah.
She was a great villain.
Whereas this is just, oh, of course he's a Russian/German mad doctor.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
I mean, he's back to being a cold-hearted bastard, which I like, because he shoots those guards with the sniper rifle in the last issue.
Yeah.
Where he shoots them and then shoots them again because he can.
Yeah.
That was very reminiscent of Doctor No. You've had your six.
I did like, because what is it, like, we counted 4 shots then. More guys came out.
Yeah, more guys came out. No, he just shot the same guys twice, which was a bit, you know. But that, you know, I thought it was a decent start, but it will get better. His second one was Eidolon. Bond is in LA extracting a woman, Cadence Birdwhistle, cracking name, from her job with the Turkish consulate, where a cover has been blown. Felix tells him not to make a big deal of it, so obviously it goes tits up. The assassins are CIA, the money Birdwhistle found being moved about was going to the UK, and the airport is closed due to a bomb threat. With no way out, Bond calls in an extraction team, and he and Birdwhistle make it to London, where they may be in even more danger. Despite being a separate miniseries, and it holds up as a separate miniseries, it does hold up as a separate, is its own thing.
It's part of the ongoing.
It is very part of the Varga story, because the Felix in this has one of the artificial limbs that the Varga guy was developing.
This is issues 7, 8, and so on.
Through 12.
Yeah.
And so the fact that they didn't renumber the series.
Yeah.
Because that's another thing Dynamite does. Whenever you get a new creative team on these, it's a separate series.
Yeah.
There's not been a continuing Bond comic book.
Yeah.
Everyone has been a 6-issue miniseries or whatever.
Even though this Warren Ellis one was pitched as an ongoing.
Yeah. So it ran for 12 issues. And then when the next guy comes in, they started back at number one.
Yeah.
And they just pitched them a separate number series. Eidolon, sorry, means a phantom or a spectre. So who do you think the bad guy's going to be, if that means spectre?
Yeah.
Masters actions. I thought he's my... I'm not a fan of Bond in America. I always think it just makes it look like any other generic action series when he's in America. Like the License to Kill criticism you had. It's just Miami Vice.
Yeah.
We've watched Miami Vice every week taking place in Miami.
Yeah.
And the Florida Keys.
Yeah.
There's nothing exotic or different or that you've not seen before about that. Whereas the Bond films are at the best when they're taking place in an exotic location that you don't see on TV every week.
Yeah.
So I'm not really a fan of that, which is why I'm not really bothered that they've never adapted Bond in New York.
Well, there's nothing goes on in Bond in New York. He comes up with a scrambled egg recipe, which, by the way...
Yeah, but you're in for... You're there for that.
I stick to that scrambled egg recipe every time now, and it's a banging recipe.
Is it?
Bond was onto something. Oh, okay. It's a good recipe.
He knows his food.
He does.
He absolutely knows his food.
There's anything. Well, that's my biggest problem with these comics is the fact that
Bond never stops to tell you for 20 minutes how he's made his scrambled eggs.
Bond does not have spend most of his time, by the way, having a cold shower, followed by a hot shower, followed by scrambled egg and 4 fingers of bourbon.
And that's his breakfast.
That's his breakfast.
Yeah. So I enjoyed both of them. I think I enjoyed Eidolon more than I enjoyed Varga.
Right.
I don't know why. I just did.
I found that it was just very flat. The Spectre reveal was flat. the hard real payoff was flat. The whole thing with these is just, they just felt a bit lacking, a bit flat for me.
Yeah.
I just didn't.
All right, not an auspicious beginning then. So I'm hoping that this improves as we go along.
Will get better.
Oh, good. Well, I agree entirely with that.
Yes.
Hammerhead is the next. I don't have all of these. These are picked up trade paperbacks in cheap. As you can tell by the condition of this, when I picked these up in cheap bins in comic book cons and stuff like that. Hammerhead was written by Andy Diggle with art by Luca Casalanguida. I think I'm saying that right. Bond is assigned to take out radical anti-capitalist Kraken, but all is not what it seems when Bond learns it's all a ploy by an even more radical right-wing loyalist who steals nuclear warheads with a view to making Britain great again. The villain in this one, I thought she was brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, she might as well have had a sign over her head saying bad guy from the get-go.
Yeah.
Because it's exactly the same as the world is not enough, which you've not got there yet.
Right,
the
okay.
The villain of the piece,
yeah.
Ostensibly the villain of the piece, the dad is murdered and the daughter is supposedly heartbroken.
Right.
Turns out to be the bad guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's exactly the same as this. What I like about the trade paperbacks, if you don't get the actual issues, they don't have any credits pages. They go straight into the pre-credit sequence, which is always an action beat.
Yeah.
And then they have the credits. So even though this is literary Bond,
yeah,
that is very definitely mimicking the structure of the film.
I did like that. The only kind of caveat to it, though, is they always do it, but there's one, it might be the next one or another one, where it's just a couple of guys having a conversation. So while I appreciate the intention, the trades are doing something that wasn't there in the comics, so it doesn't necessarily work as well.
In this one it does, because it opens with an action beat.
Yeah.
And I wonder if Diggle knew they were going to do this in the trade paperback.
Maybe.
Because it's possible, and some of the other writers don't know that. I don't know. Such movie staples as the pre-credit sequence, the locations, the girls, the weaponries, they're all out of the films in this one.
Yeah.
But it's book Bond. This is the one I was on about earlier on. There's no quips.
Yeah.
There's no snappy patter. There's no gadgets per se. Bond is pretty much relying on his wits and his skills to survive.
Yeah.
But this one made me think of Brosnan's Bond.
Okay.
Whereas other ones will make me think of different incarnations.
Yeah.
But I did actually think that this was a very good literary Bond in a film plot.
Yeah, this one I vibed with this one much more, and I kind of hate to use the word because I think it's overused, but it's much grittier and it works, and the art shows that much better. The art's dynamic and exciting and muddy at times in a way that just kind of works.
It all comes together. The art is better in this one. Yeah, I do agree with you.
And
she's got like a cartoony anime vibe to her.
Yeah.
But it's still cool.
I did like the villain because it's very kind of one-dimensional villain, but it's fun. This is what I mean about the villains of the last one being very flat. This one, it's fun. She's a fun villain. Mm. And I think what's more so interesting about her is the fact that she speaks in a way that a lot of people at the moment are speaking. You know, it's very definitely intentional, the line, make Britain great again.
Yeah. Well, you've got that thing. You've got the line about tea.
Yes, was taken. James Bond hates tea because it's the mud that was the fall of the British Empire. is a line from the Fleming books, yeah.
Yeah, and they have that literal conversation here, and he says that about Tate. And Victoria's the villain. She's called Tory.
Yeah.
That's like Diggle's signposting it.
Yeah.
And I love Bond's response to that. I'd hate to hear what your enemies call you. That was genuinely funny.
It's really good as well. And I like James Bond. He is a weapon who will fight for king and country.
Mm.
But at the same time, like, even he knows a bad person from a bad person.
Mm.
We've had recently, saying no names, but we've had a previous prime minister saying the exact line, make Britain great again.
Yeah.
You know, when was that? When we used to beat our wives and have signs up saying no blacks, no Irish?
Yeah.
Like, and James Bond is the kind of guy who's like, God, I'm a bad guy, but you need to shut up.
Yes. I'm a bad guy for pay.
Yeah.
But I've still got a conscience. But yeah, I thought Victoria was just a fantastic villain in this. And he gets the tone just right. Bond's taking this serious enough.
Yeah.
And certainly the ending, where she's basically going to nuke London.
Yeah.
I also love that Moneypenny is willing to sacrifice M.
Yeah.
In the same way that M is willing to sacrifice his agent.
Get the job
he
done.
Is just as accept. He is just as sacrificable, yeah. If that's a word.
Yeah.
He is just as expendable, that's the word I'm looking for, as any of his agents.
Which we'll revisit later on in the Ennis one as well.
Yeah. And I like that at the end of it, they actually have that conversation, would you have killed me?
Yeah.
And she doesn't reply, and M says, probably better that I don't know. Yeah.
I did like Bond being his naval commander again.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that he absolutely obliterates the bad guys as well with the rail cannon itself.
Yeah, oh, he's completely ruthless in this one, which is what I loved about it. And it has got all the movie plot ticks.
Yeah.
Femme fatale, traitor, ticking clock, world at stake.
Yeah,
all of that is you could put Roger Moore in this and add a few quips, and it would change the tone of it, but it would still work.
A bit more Dalton-y, maybe Brosnan.
That's what I mean when I say I saw Brosnan doing this story.
Yeah, yeah.
But this was my favourite one, Hammerhead.
Yeah, yeah.
Genuinely, and when you consider that we've got a Garth Ennis one coming up, because I think this perfectly put Bond in a film plot with an OTT but very relatable and of the time villain that worked spectacularly well. That's Hammerhead for those that are listening.
It's a better way of doing politics as well. I think there's a line in the Warren Ellis one where they're like, oh, you know, they have to read Angela Merkel's emails. It's like, come on, are we doing this? Whereas this one uses the politics a bit more timelessly
subtly, and puts it in a James Bond story framework that works.
Yeah,
whereas sometimes, well, Ellis is a little bit too arch in his politics, and there's only so far you can push the politics in a James Bond story.
I think
really
he's the type of writer as well who wants you to know
he
doesn't quite get the subtlety.
Yeah, whereas what Diggle did in that was really good.
Which is quite interesting to kind of have subtlety in an over-the-top James Bond action series.
And it is OTT.
Yeah.
She is positively scenery tuned by the end of it.
Yeah.
I was trying to think who would have been good as her if they adapt that into a film.
Mm.
And I was just thinking Charlize Theron would kill in this role.
Yeah.
She'd be fantastic.
It was fun to see the femme fatale and the villain be the same person.
Yes.
Which is very, if ever, done.
You get that in Kill Chain.
Yeah.
There's a femme fatale in this one as well. Kill Chain, due to the machinations of the team out to destroy NATO, allied agents are killed, pitting the CIA against MI6, with Bond and Felix caught in the middle. Can they find the real adversary and restore diplomatic relations before it's too late? Again, Andy Diggle and Luca Caslanguida. This is much more of a spy thriller than Hammerhead. So Diggle has delivered both types of Bond story. He's done moderately realistic spy thriller.
Yeah.
Moderately. Like, you know, From Russia With Love kind of thing. And OTT world conquering villain threatens all life on Earth. This still has a real world with talk of populist politicians pulling out of NATO.
Yeah.
Russia sowing discord. All of that stuff plays into the story.
Yeah.
And this is why Diggle's two miniseries were my favourite ones that we read for this.
And it worked the same way that Fleming's books worked, because they actually had Cold War stuff going on that fed into it.
Yeah.
You know, this works in that same kind of way. There's so much, you know, political upheaval and things at the moment that if you utilise and distill in the correct way, it just really works.
Yeah. Rika van der Havik.
Yes, yeah.
Is, again, a fascinating villain. Unlike the last one, where Victoria was played as a good guy who turned bad, she's bad from the get-go.
Yeah.
And she's all the more impressive. I liked this, that Bond was on the outs with the CIA.
Mm.
So he's got really no one he can trust. And then there's a great conversation, I think, in the middle of this one, where him and Felix basically have a heart-to-heart conversation.
Yeah.
Where Felix trusts Bond enough to believe what he's telling him.
Mm.
That this wasn't us. This wasn't MI5. We didn't do this.
Yeah.
something's going on, Felix. You've got a fox in the hen house in the CIA. And Felix trusts him to let him get away to prove what he's saying. I thought that was really good. And it's interesting, Daniel Craig is really the only one who's had a relationship with Felix.
Yeah, yeah.
Because for the other guys, it was a different Felix every time.
And also, I think Felix as well rarely ever kind of rose to above more of a supporting role.
Mm.
Whereas, yeah, it's still a supporting role in this, but there's more... He has more of an impact on the story and on Bond throughout this as well.
You get the impression Felix is his only friend.
Regardless of who they work for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the books, that's more Bill Tanner.
Yeah.
He has a relationship with Bill Tanner with away from work.
Chief of staff, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas in this, you get the feeling that Felix goes to bat for him because he believes him.
Mm.
And by letting him escape, he's given him a chance to prove what he says. But if you get killed, it's not coming back on me.
Yeah.
You escaped.
Yeah.
So I love that. The dialogue in this is, again, very Bond. Not quippy, but funny. Roger Moore could have delivered this wonderfully. It's a bit quippier in this one than in Hammerhead. But the story's not a Roger Moore story. The story's a Daniel Craig story.
I don't even think it's a Daniel Craig story. It's a bit too... The thing with these ones is they're a bit more action-y for even Daniel Craig. Daniel Craig was throwing himself down stairwells and beating up people.
And through walls.
He wasn't doing the whole big gunfight alongside the Navy on a submarine type vibes. Mm. No Bond really has, apart from maybe Brosnan.
Connery.
You think?
For your... You Only Live Twice.
Yeah.
The attack on the base at
okay,
the end.
Yeah.
But yeah, I loved these two. And for me, I mean, again, I've not read all of them. I keep having a look at Comic Cons and if there's any more that I've not got. Because at the moment, it's on hiatus, isn't it?
Oh, is it?
Yeah, there's not been a Dynamite Bond series since Garth Ennis finished.
Right.
At the beginning of this year.
Yeah.
Not the beginning of this year, over summer.
Hmm.
But Gail Simone has been announced as the next writer for the next miniseries.
Okay.
But she was only announced after Ennis finished.
Yeah.
So I wonder, and this is just speculation on my part, had the contract ended after 10 years... And they've renegotiated the contract, but not with enough time to get Gail Simone's on the stand immediately following Ennis's.
Right.
So there's a little bit of a gap here, but it does mean they can still publish stuff.
The thing with this one as well is Greg Smallwood does the covers for them, and he does such a great James Bond that I almost wish he did the interior art as well.
Reflections of Death is a complete graphic novel, not a collection. And again, that's a fantastic cover.
It's a great cover. It's a shame that it's kind of framed the way it is, because that is a great piece of art.
Yeah, Faye Dalton did this cover. It's a very pulp, hard case crime cover.
Yeah.
The only publisher who's still doing pulp covers. Bond points his gun whilst looking straight in the eye, playing with a bullet. I originally thought he was smoking, but he isn't. He's just playing with a bullet.
It's very Robert McGinnis-y.
Yes, he's flanked by a woman in bondage and another woman in a slinky dress, packing heat. So basically all of your bases are covered. An all-new, all-original James Bond graphic novel. So this was not published as a series of miniseries. This was an original graphic novel by a collection of writers. The Broker by Vita Ayala and Danny Law, with art by Jordi Perez. The Rare Dinner by Benjamin Percy and Cuba Ball. The Oddest Job by Greg Pak and Dean Kotz. One Pistol, Three Silencers by Gail Simone and Ion. Is that pronounced Ion? Because it's Irish, isn't it?
Owen.
Is it Owen? Maron. Men Without a Country by Mark Russell and Robert Curry. The Hook by Andy Diggle and Luca Castellaguida. And that was it. An overarching story sees Moneypenny kidnapped, and under duress, she tells tales of Bond, all written by different writers and drawn by different artists, as mentioned. The stories all show a different side of Bond, a man of wealthy tastes, the thug, the killer, the ladies' man, the loyal agent, his one Achilles heel, his friendship with Felix, and how to live the life he lives but never off the job. The funniest story in the book is Bond babysitting Felix's kids. I don't know how accurate to character it is, but, you know, the more brutal tales, though, don't shy away from how we can never really trust anybody. I genuinely enjoyed this for the most part.
It's an anthology, so it's quite hit and miss.
Yeah.
I don't quite buy Bond going out for a few drinks with Moneypenny. Bond either drinks on his own or plays cards.
Yeah.
That's it. So I didn't quite buy that. But this first story I really liked, where he just keeps... He's on a date and he keeps popping into the bathroom to beat up more bad guys.
To take out more bad guys.
Turns out his date was a spy using him all along.
Yeah. To take out those bad guys.
Yeah.
So that was quite cool. I did like that.
That's very... It's maybe a bit too funny for Daniel Craig, but it's definitely a Daniel Craig setup.
Mm. I don't know. I think Craig could have pulled it off if he took that stick out of his ass.
The next one, I didn't dig as much with him out with a few drinks with the other guy. But this is more of a sequel to another Dynamite comic that we haven't covered.
Oh, is it?
So I didn't... Yeah, the talking... Essentially, this is an epilogue to another miniseries.
Right.
So that's probably a reason why I didn't vibe with it as much.
Oh, see, I didn't mind that one. He just meets up with another agent for dinner where they ostensibly talk, not shop, but it just ends up being another mission. So.
And again, he finds that he was used anyway.
Yeah. Is this the Felix one?
This is Felix one, yeah.
The one with Gail Simone.
This is one that I didn't like. And the thing with these is the credits are all at the start, but I mean, I'd forgotten anyway. But you don't get the credits until after the story finishes. So I didn't like this one. Bond fell out of character. I don't know why he's overly sentimental and sees himself as a father figure to kids that we never knew existed.
Yeah.
Why is he going out of his way to be the imposing father figure? Why is he all of a sudden giving an internal monologue to us about being a sentimental father figure?
Why does he care about high school proms?
Yeah, it didn't work. For me, anyway, it was my least favourite. But I've never really kind of vibed with Gail Simone anyway. As a writer, like, I've never cared for her writing that much. So when I found that it was hers, I was like, oh, right.
Yeah, right, okay.
I'm not surprised. Yeah. The next one was fine, where he goes into the... I actually quite liked it, but it wasn't a standout one for me. I liked that Bond sneaks into this black base to meet 003, is it?
Yeah, who's
sold him out regardless, yeah.
Who's turned to the bad guys.
It felt very prison breaky.
Yeah, I mean, it's... Yeah, I think as a whole, they all held up quite well. The Diggle one was good, as usual.
Yeah.
The Andy Diggle one was one of the better ones.
This is very Daniel Craig-y as well, where the minister or whatever is actually the bad guy, and Bond knows that.
Yeah.
Because I love the ruthlessness.
Yeah.
Of, I'm meeting my contact. Oh, so I don't need you then.
Yeah. You need to keep me alive to meet the contact. No, I don't.
Which is very big in the Casino Royale.
Yeah. Then what do I need you for? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good one, that one. And then the overarching story is concluded with Moneypenny. It
really is mostly superfluous, but...
And again, if this is book Bond, why is he driving an Aston Martin?
Yeah.
Because he drives a Jag in the books or a Bentley?
It's a Bentley.
Is it a Bentley?
Yeah.
And it's even got the license plate BMT 216R.
Which he does mention, because in the other ones, the minis, he is driving a Bentley.
Yeah, but in this he's got the Aston Martin.
Yeah.
So that clearly seems to signify movie Bond. And finally tonight, we have got Your Cold, Cold Heart, written by Garth Ennis, with art by Rafa Lobosco. Bond uncovers a long dormant scheme by the Russians involving steel water, which I thought was a bit dumb. But I liked it. It's quite clever. A bioweapon that freezes water around people, killing them instantly, and then obviously it just dissipates as it melts, leaving no traces to how they died.
Yeah.
MI6 stole it after the Cold War, and M assigns Bond to find out who is suddenly using it, because it ain't us. Turns out the Russians let MI6 steal it to complete it and then steal it back and move the CIA are a little bit pissed off about.
Yeah.
Before this can become an international incident, Bond is tasked with retrieving the formula. It's Garth Ennis doing a James Bond story. So it's Garth Ennis doing Bond, but with exploding eyeballs.
Yeah, it never... We've said before how with Garth Ennis, it's either the best thing you've read or the worst thing, and there's no in-between. Interestingly, this is somewhere in the in-between.
Yeah, weirdly, yeah, I agree entirely with that.
And it's kind of sometimes leans a bit near the pastiche line, but reins itself in enough. Like the opening sequence where the drug crime lord swears revenge and Bond's already there. He's just gone, I knew you'd do this. I'm tying up loose ends.
That's very Punisher, isn't it?
Borders on the pastiche, but Ennis does a good enough job of reining it in enough.
Yeah.
And we never linger on it. M gives him a bollocking and we move on.
Yes, because he shouldn't have taken him out.
Yeah.
Or he shouldn't have taken out the entire family. And that, I couldn't agree with. I read that opening and thought, oh dear, is this what we're in for?
Yeah.
Fortunately, once we get the M scene and the briefing of what the mission is, like you see, he reins himself in a bit more.
Yeah.
And it isn't a Punisher pastiche.
Mm.
Or overly violent. I mean, there's still a bit more violence in it than whatever. But there is a nice subtle piece of storytelling in it. The woman in Q Branch testing the weapons is later leading the hit squad on Bond at the beach.
Right.
Killing Archibald Tyrant. And that's never spelt out or mentioned.
Right.
You are reading this going, well, how did they know this meeting was taking place? And then you go back and go, oh, right. So there's a reason that woman earlier had read her, so that they can show you that the woman leading the mission here has read her.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite clever.
I liked the weapon in this. I thought it was quite interesting. You know, it's always been kind of a recurring conversation piece of, oh, well, what murder weapon would you use, hypothetically? And the best murder weapon, really, is an icicle.
Yeah.
Because it melts. So this is just taking that to an extreme, step, yeah.
It still seemed a bit silly, though, didn't it? Yeah. Let's be honest. But all right, whatever. I love Bond taking the bus.
See, I didn't... It would have been funny, but he's very clearly on quite a comfortable coach.
Yeah.
As someone who uses buses quite a lot.
Yes.
This is luxury. We had a bloody box in the middle of the sea.
Did you walk to work uphill both ways?
My dad, he'd wake up in the morning and he'd kill us to death. And we were happy. He's on a luxurious coach, Bond is here.
I wonder if that's... I don't know what nationality the artist is. But yeah, if this was a regular bus, this would have been much funnier.
Yes.
Because regular buses are piss-strewn.
yeah.
Full of just like... And chewing gum everywhere.
Everyone would be watching TikToks on loud volume because no one buys headphones anymore.
Because no one has headphones anymore because iPhone removed the thingy or the jack plug.
It does have the great panel where Bond is looking at a crying baby and going, yes, I'm in the mood for killing someone.
it was quite funny. But yes, it's the art though that makes you go, that's not a bus. That's not a London bus. But, you know, it is what it is. We've had Bond in space before in Moonraker.
Yeah.
Him releasing a snake into someone's spacesuit is just silly. It's funny.
Yeah.
But it's very, very silly. And I did like the ending to that, where if he was any man but James Bond, I'd presume he's just got me to send him into space just so he can go into space. But, you know, it's what, sir. It's funny.
It does lean... It's a bit more Moore-y, the end one. Which is surprising. I wouldn't have thought that Garth Ennis would have done a Roger Moore.
Well, especially seeing as all the interviews I read with him, he's on about, I didn't really like the films. There are fine diversions. But then I read the books.
Right.
And I thought, no, there's a character here.
Yeah.
What
he's done is a Roger Moore film.
Yeah, but not with Roger Moore in it.
Yeah.
Roger Moore's not in there.
I did like that he gave Moneypenny her own mission and her own, well, not femme fatale, but...
Someone she had to deal with.
Yeah.
So Moneypenny's got her own. Because they've really positioned Naomi Harris's Moneypenny as a capable agent, haven't they?
Yeah.
So...
I did like how she seduced him by going, oh, why don't I go get one of my toys? And then she throws a grenade at him.
Yeah, it's pure Ennis in many ways. And the Dynamite series hasn't shied away from the more unsavoury elements of Bond's character in any of the stories. But we're not reveling in the violence as much here as you would expect from an Ennis story. His saving grace is the humour, although he does delve into politics, discussing the CIA and MI6's sometimes contentious relationship. But the overall feeling that both of us need to do something about the current leader of the country behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's still an issue. Still, there's no skimping on action. Some of it's very well rendered. The art in this is good. Yeah. I like the art in this one a lot.
And I think it helps Ennis's case that he's not being overly gratuitous, because the series around it have already been overly gratuitous, that this feels like it's just in a similar vein.
Yeah.
So while it is gratuitous, it's no more gratuitous than what's come before it.
Yes, and I don't think you're seeing this level of violence on a Bond film anytime soon.
Yeah, because I think there is a couple of bits, and even the Andy Diggle one, where you see him Bond just shoot someone's brains out, and it does take you back, but by the time you get to Garth Ennis, who you would expect that of, it doesn't feel out of place.
No, so they have dealt with the violence in previous series, so this doesn't seem as ridiculous as it could. Felix and Q don't get a lot to do, but M and Moneypenny are very well characterised.
Yeah.
Ennis can sometimes miss the mark when he's working on licensed characters, but not here. This was not a disappointment. Bond is dark and sardonic, and his sense of humour is present and correct. There's some good bantering between him and Moneypenny.
I did like when he turns around and there's the big burly Russian and he goes, "Why is there always one of you bastards?"
Who just would not die, no matter how many times. He had to eventually just cut him in half.
Well, no, it's the plane guns him down, doesn't it?
Yes, the plane guns him down and he gets cut in half. But yeah, it's... Overall, I mean, there's a lot of Red Sonja adverts in these comics.
Again, with Dynamite putting all of their money into the cover art.
You
know, I have no interest in Red Sonja and Vampirella, but, you know, this is making me a bit more interested.
And Elvira.
Yeah.
You know where the market is, don't you? This was not a comprehensive review. We only looked at the comics we own. Obviously, we don't have all of Dynamite's run. I will try and fix that as we go along and look through the comic book back issues and stuff like that. But Dynamite's run have, by these examples, been pretty good.
Yeah, it's neither book Bond nor film Bond. It's its own thing.
Yeah.
They're perfectly fine. I don't think there's anything here that will make me want to come back or carry on, but for what they are, if you are interested, I do think they are at least worth a read.
If you like James Bond and you've never read any of the comics, certainly the two Andy Diggle ones, Hammerhead and Killchain, I'd heartily recommend them as being the best of this bunch that we read.
Yeah.
I think. I'll pick up more as and when the opportunity presents itself. I'm not going to run paying over the odds for them.
Yeah, well, I think that in and of itself is a review of them. I'll pick them up in the cheap bins.
Yeah, they're good.
Yeah.
They're good and fine, and certainly, like I said, the Andy Diggle ones were absolutely brilliant. And as the movies seem mired in indecision, it's gratifying to see that the comics and the books will continue and give us new Bond adventures, because despite some mishandling here and there, it does seem like James Bond will return.
You see what I did there?
Anyway, that was grand. I enjoyed that. That was quite good. Next time, is it Dragon Ball Z?
We will return to Dragon Ball Z next time. Jump forward in time to see where Goku's up to.
That's absolutely fantastic.
Yes.
Yes. So that'll be next time. So I will continue my education into the world of Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
And you only ever knew Dragon Ball Z because that's what you grew up with.
Well, this will straddle that line, as you will find out.
Right.
It's an evolution of the Dragon Ball, which we covered,
right,
but through more of a superhero lens. So, you know, we're going to balance some things now.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good to know. So Dragon Ball Z's next time on an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics. Like, subscribe, smash those like buttons, give us 5 stars. Review us on iTunes. All these things help. On Apple Podcasts, sorry, iTunes doesn't exist anymore, does it?
Right, okay.
Do all that stuff. Tell your friends. Tell all your friends. And we'll be back next time.
Goodbye.
See you later. Hey Kids Comics is a The Devil Will Make Work for Idle Hands to Do production and hosted by Andrew and Michael Leyland. All opinions expressed in the show are the opinions of the hosts and no one else. The free-to-use music that closes and opens the show was the Sci-Fi Cyberpunk trailer by somebody called Stringer Bell on the Pixabay.com free-to-use website. Thank you very much to him. If you would like to support the show, you can buy Michael and I, or both of us, or one of us, a coffee. Go to ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com/A Leyland. In 1 month, an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics, coming in your ears. It's a date.